Okay, so let's start on tonight's questions. There's a lot in here, so we'll see how we go. Okay. Dear Ajahn, giving joy inspiration is good. Someone in the cult, for example, the Dhammakaya, people give to this cult with joy and also because of inspiration from the leader. Is that act of giving considered good karma or wrong understanding? Thank you. Okay, that's a good question. When do we know that we are giving in the right way? And part of the idea of giving is also to investigate where you are giving, whether it is really worthwhile. So you have to use your wisdom as well. And of course, the more wisdom you use in the act of giving, it is even better karma. So investigate where it is worthwhile, where the kind of the results of the giving will be the best for Buddhism as a cause, for example, or whatever cause that you are giving to. For example, if you know that there is a certain scam going on, there's no point in giving to a scam, because if you give to a scam, you're just kind of keeping bad people in business and kind of making things worse very often. And sometimes religious cults, they are a bit like scams, yeah, similar kind of problem as a scam. So you don't really want to give there to keep wrong view going. This is often the problem. You kind of just perpetuate problems if you give to places that have wrong ideas about something, wrong ideas about Buddhism or whatever it is. If you give to those places, then very often it kind of makes things worse. Especially sometimes in cults you have, abuse going on as well. And if there's no point in giving to places where people get abused, that's really also a bad idea. So use your wisdom and give where kind of it's going to have general benefit to society and everyone. That is really the ideal way of giving. If you give to Dhammakaya, if you are considered that a cult, and I would tend to agree with you, it is a bit cultish and has many strange kind of weird things going on with that particular sect. Is never bad because you're still giving. You're still as far as you're concerned, the people who are there, they see the good in that cult. You're still doing something positive from their point of view. Of course, if you give to a cause that you know to be evil, because you want to perpetuate something evil, then it might actually be bad because your ultimate motivation is bad. But if your motivation is to support something that you believe is good, it's going to be okay because your motivation is pure. So just know your motivation, and then you know whether it's good or bad karma. But investigating is always good. It just increases the good karma that you're making here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, the act of generosity brings joy and happiness and merits. Wouldn't one rather give to the Sangha to be safe, or the causes that inspire may later turn out to be scallywags and cause grief and regrets? Thank you. If you feel inspired to give to the Sangha, it's great. I certainly wouldn't stop you from doing it. I think that's a good thing to do. But giving to the Sangha as a community rather than giving to individuals is a good way of doing things, because then you include everyone in your act of generosity rather than giving to individuals. And the Buddha says it's always better to give to the whole community, the whole Sangha, than it is to give to individuals. That is a very useful starting point. The idea of giving, yes, sometimes people may turn out to be scallywags or whatever. You can never be absolutely sure that your generosity is going to be used well. But if you give broadly, the majority of what you give is going to be used well. And that is really what you should focus on. If occasionally it goes astray, okay. That's the way things are. There's nothing we can really do about that. But don't become too cynical. Don't try to give only to the good places, because you never really know whether ultimately your gift is going to be used well. Even within the Sangha, you can't be 100% sure. Yeah, you give, you hope it's going to be well, but you just can't really be absolutely sure about it. So I would recommend you to follow the Buddha's advice. Yeah, when you feel inclined, you feel generosity arising, you feel compassion, you feel that you want to give, you feel inspired, give. Don't worry, don't wait till you're 100% sure that your generosity is going to be used well. If you want to be 100% sure, you're going to end up never giving anything at all. And then you miss out on all the kind of good things that comes from generosity and giving here. So don't be too kind of perfectionist when it comes to the act of generosity here. Yes. Okay. So I hope that works. Dear Ajahn Vemmali, thank you immensely for spending the morning, day and night with us for 10 days, solely out of compassion for Sadhu Times 3. Yes, it is nice to have compassion. I also do it for my own sake. I usually love to read the suttas. I often find it inspiring myself, so it's out of compassion for myself as well here. My apologies, but I have three questions. That's right, one piece of paper with three questions. Actually, we should multiply each question by, if they all were like that, I'm going to multiply them by three, so it looks like there's a lot, but actually there might be much more than it seems. Anyway, first number one. If anapanasati is all we need for insight and liberation, what about the jhanas? Are they incorporated in anapanasati? They are incorporated. Come to the very end of Anapanasati Sutta, or not the very end, because the very last part shows the insight aspect of Anapanasati. But out of the 16 steps, when you come to step number 12, and we'll see this tomorrow, you come to a step called Vimochayang Chittang in Pali, and that means liberating the mind. And that liberation of the mind is when you enter a deep state of samadhi. And that would be mostly reference to the jhanas that you have there. So they are actually included in the Anapanasati Sutta. They are also included in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is kind of strange, because Satipatthana is usually what leads to samadhi, and it is not obvious why it should include samadhi. But if you look at some of the factors in the Satipatthana Sutta, they also point to jhana, mahagata citta. You contemplate the mahagata citta. Mahagata means the mind, the great mind. It refers to samadhi mind. Niramisa sukha, the happiness of the unworldly or spiritual happiness. This is happiness that refers to jhana or samadhi experiences in particular. Vimutta citta, again, same thing. The liberated mind refers to samadhi experiences. So everything really points to that being one of the important milestones in meditation, the deep samadhi here, including also in the Anapanasati Sutta. Number two, you said that the mind is what we carry with us from life to life. Could you please explain what is the mind and the citta? I find it difficult to differentiate between consciousness and mind. There isn't really any absolute distinction between consciousness and mind. Consciousness is an essential ingredient of mind. You cannot have mind without consciousness. Consciousness is what makes something a mind. Awareness is like the most basic thing that makes something into a citta or mind. But mind is more than just consciousness. Mind is also the feelings you have. It is the perceptions that we have sometimes. Mind also includes very often volition, the will, the things, the doer inside is also part of the mind, except in samadhi when the doer temporarily kind of disappears. But usually it is there in the background and doing a little bit of work in the background. So all of these things are aspects of mind. And so when I say the mind carries on, what I really mean is not like a mind is a thing. A mind is a stream. And that's why we often talk about the stream of consciousness, the vijnana sota, which goes from one life to another life. And it's a bit like a river. A river is like a stream, yeah? And if you think about a river, what it looks like, a river, if you look at the river at two consecutive moments, what you see is different water. One moment to the next one, the water is different. The molecules are not the same one moment after the other one, one moment following the previous one. always changing. But if you look at the shape of the river, the shape of the river is roughly the same. The shape of the river only changes slowly according to the seasons, according to amount of rain, according to droughts or whatever it is. There's a slow change in the shape of the river. And the overall shape of the river is like your personality. You have a certain personality, certain habits, a certain way of being. And that changes very slowly depending on how you live your life, whether you have a spiritual practice or not and all of that. And that general shape of the mind, that is what carries on from one life to the next one. It doesn't mean there is a thing, because the water molecules and the mind states are changing all the time, but the general shape is still the same. That is what goes on from one life to the next one. So you bring your habits with you. You bring that general happiness, degree of happiness you have built up, the kind of the brightness of the mind, all of these things you bring with you. So remember that. Yeah, if you have bad habits in this life, you're going to have them again in your next life. It's kind of scary, isn't it? You bring these things with you from one life to the next one. It's kind of, help, I want to get out of this. And there are some good stories about that, about people remembering their past lives and seeing that in this life, all they are doing is carrying out the same habits they built up in past lives, carrying on those habits in the present life. Thinking that they are autonomous agents, thinking that they are people who acting out of free will. And then one day realizing that you look back in your past life and realizing that you're actually only playing out that program that was laid down and was programmed in the past sometime. And when you see that, it's kind of frightening, because you start to feel like a robot. You feel like this, you're on these rails, you're railroaded down a certain track. You have no choice. You think that you're coming here to Dharma Grove on your own accord. But no, you're like a robot. Yeah. As soon as the Dharma Grove website says meditation retreat is open, you go to the computer, you type in your name or whatever, yeah, and you get in here. Like a robot. Kind of scary. Of course, coming here is quite good, because this is the railroad which leads you hopefully to the end of being railroaded. But all of these things that we do in life, which feels like it comes out of our own free will, we do it because we think it's good. Yeah, working hard, doing this, whatever it is. Then we're just doing it because of past habits. And that's kind of frightening. So you want to get out of those habits as quickly as possible. And that is very much what the spiritual path is about, an important part of the spiritual path. Anyway, question number 3 on generosity. Could you please elaborate again on the point about where you should give, and the most meritorious giving not being the same? Should not giving to be determined by the need of recipient rather than benefit to the giver? Can generosity be cultivated, or should one give only when inspired? We must better that. You should not give only when inspired, because sometimes inspiration may not come. Yeah, sometimes it can be hard to, inspiration may not always be there. So if you think that this is good to give sometimes, it's good to support something, it doesn't have to be a profound inspiration. Just the feeling that something is the right thing to do, that can be good enough. That gets you started. Yeah. And you can kind of volunteer for things or whatever it is, and you can help out with tiny little things. So you do that. So whether you feel very inspired or not doesn't matter, but it's better if you feel really inspired. It's better if you feel really good about it, but don't expect that, because that is asking too much sometimes. Should it giving be determined by the need of the recipient rather than the benefit of the giver? Well, the point is that the need of the recipient is very often what makes you feel inspired. Yeah, because you see the need, you feel compassion for somebody, or you feel whatever it is, and then that gives rise to the compassion and inspiration, because you're feeling compassion and inspiration, give. Yeah, in that situation, it's always right to give. So you give because of that. If you give because of feeling that it is good to the giver, it becomes too selfish. Yeah, it becomes like that person who's calculating, having a spreadsheet again, calculating the amount of good karma they're going to make. If you think like that, it destroys the whole act of giving. So don't think about how beneficial it is to you. Instead, just give when you feel inspired. Okay, so if you feel inspired to give to Buddhism or Buddhist cause, great, please do so. If you're inspired to give somewhere else, give there. The point is that giving is not of equal merit. You can give it to an animal, and that's nice, but the merit is not so great. You can give it to an ordinary human being, that's much more merit. You can give it to a very virtuous human being, as even more merit. You can give it to the whole Sangha, is even more merit, because merit is composed of many different factors. If you give it to a place where that generosity spreads out to a large number of people, and it creates a large amount of happiness in the world, then you can see why there is more good karma in giving to such a cause, because you're using your wisdom to think, well, why? How can my generosity have the maximum effect in the world to create more happiness all around, reduce the suffering in the world? And because you're using your wisdom in a sense in that way, it means that you are, because of that, there is more positive karma in that sort of giving. So what determines the good karma is how you feel about the situation. What kind of effect it has in society around you, and all of these things are part and parcel that determines the effect of your good karma. Yes, I hope that makes sense, and let's go on to the next one. When you teach the subsequent sequence of the Anapanasati tomorrow, please explain it along with the process mentioned in MN44, the Chula Vedala Sutta, page 396, paragraph 14-21. Okay, I'm not sure how the tetrads correspond to the jhana states. It seems to me that the fourth tetrad is way beyond the fourth jhana. Please help me to understand it. Okay, I will try to help understand. I cannot guarantee I will make you see the light, but I can kind of help a little bit. The point is that the Anapanasati Sutta, and as always, there is a degree of interpretation in that sutta. Yeah, and sometimes when you read the commentaries, they interpret the piti and sukha that we looked at today, the rapture and the sukha, as jhana states. At least that's one interpretation of the commentaries. But there are also other interpretations. And I think that interpretation is too advanced, because it is parallels with the Satipatthana Sutta. And Satipatthana Sutta really is about the practice that leads up to samadhi. If you look at, I didn't talk about this, but it's actually a very important principle of the practice. You look at the Noble Eightfold Path, which we'll have a look at later on. You look at the five spiritual faculties. You look at the seven factors of awakening. And what you see is always the same sequence. First of all, you have the energy or the effort. Then you have the Satipatthana, and then you have Samadhi coming after that. And in all those instances, there is a causal sequence. Right effort leads to Satipatthana. Satipatthana leads to Samadhi and the jhanas. It's always the same thing. So the purpose of Satipatthana really is to lead you to Samadhi. Yeah, through both a mixture of insight and samatha practice. Satipatthana is both about insight and samatha, and it leads you to the jhana states. That is the purpose of this. This is one of those very important things. So when we look at the Anapanasati Sutta, it is really only when you come to the 12th step, which is, as I mentioned before, vimochayang chittang, liberating the mind, that is really what is a reference to the jhana state, because liberation in the suttas is of two kinds. There is the temporary liberation, which is the jhana states, and then there is the permanent liberation. And here we are obviously talking about the temporary one, because the insights come after that. This is how to think about the Anapanasati Sutta, in my opinion. And that to me is the way that it makes most sense. But I will put your question aside, and I will see if I can maybe address it a bit more tomorrow, see what happens. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for the talk this morning on the importance of generosity and gratitude to our parents. Indeed, it helps during the start of meditation when I express gratitude to my parents. Okay, good. They had worked hard for my brothers and others, and to follow them working for the family, friends and others, knowing we can't take it all with us when we die. We live for the benefit of others. Is this cycle of life samsara? Okay. It is samsara. Samsara is just kind of the round of birth and death. That is really what samsara refers to. Yeah, moving on from life to life. That is really what it is. But of course, all the time, all the kind of things we do in between as well is part of samsara, samsaric cycle. So, you know, this is also what you experience in daily life, whatever, is all part of the samsaric cycle going on. But so you can live that samsaric cycle in different ways. Either you can live it in such a way that you are moving out of it, and this is kind of the idea with the spiritual path, or you can live it in such a way that you just reinforce it. But what you're talking about here is really a way of moving out of that samsara, because you are talking about using your meditation using it in a positive way. So that's good. The Buddha gave up everything, and he also lived for the benefit of others. The humankind is living for our family is an attachment. How can we break the cycle without having to enter monastic life? Thank you, Ajahn. You want to avoid monastic life, right? That's kind of many monastic life seems really tough. You have to be really super duper to be actually ordinary people become monks. You know, we're really just ordinary people. So it is, anyone can really do it. It's not. It's surprising. You, when you look from the outside, it may look like monastic life is something really kind of far out and really different. But when you look at it from the inside, it seems very ordinary. It seems very kind of just like any other life, really. It's just that you're standing on the other side of the threshold or the barrier, whatever you want to call it. Is living for our family an attachment? The point is that what do you mean by living for your family? If you do it in a wise way, it can be part of the spiritual path, and that is really what you should aim for. Yeah, you should make it part of your spiritual path to be kind and compassionate to your family, living for them in the right way, not having too many demands of them, not judging them, but allowing them to be. So it really depends what you mean by living for your family. If you live for your family in a way that you have great demands of them as well, okay, I'm going to be kind to you, but you better get straight A's back, otherwise I'm going to, you know, it's bad. Then it's like a business deal. It's not really a spiritual life anymore. Yeah, we have to kind of, we have to support each other in this way. It's a and that is not what the spiritual path is about. Unconditional love means that you help and you are kind without asking for anything in return. So live your family life. If you have children, then allow your children just to develop on their own. Don't demand too much of them. Children come into this world with their own background, with their own karma, with their own habits. And some of them are going to get A's. Some are not. Yeah, it's just they can't do it. Even if you push them to suicide, they still might not get A's. And that is often the problem. So do it in a selfless way. Do it if you're going to use it in the right way. And then the spiritual, domestic family life does become a spiritual path. Yeah, investigate if you do it rightly. Investigate if you do it in a selfless and a good way. And then it can become very positive. It is so important if you want to have success in meditation and spiritual practice, you have to make everything into the spiritual path. Everything you do. Yeah, you do everything with a right attitude. Attitude is really what everything is about. This is what I mean, focusing on the process. The process is more important. It's not about what happens to your children. It's about how you treat them. That matters. And actually, that is usually the best way to get good results with children anyway. If you treat them well, if you teach them about kindness and generosity, usually they become very psychologically very strong, and they become able to deal with life in a good way. Then it doesn't matter so much whether they have success kind of in business or whatever. Who cares? That's irrelevant. If they can be happy, if they can be well-adjusted people who are able to look after themselves and independent, that is what you really should look for, so that they can actually have a good life. Otherwise, your children become something to be proud of. I am proud of my children because they do this and they do that. But that is about you. It's not about your children. And that is a problem sometimes with the way people bring up their kids. So have that kind of unvested interest in the way that you deal with your family, whoever it is, with your parents, your children, your spouse, or whatever it is, and then you are doing it in the right way. Can we break the cycle without having to enter monastic life? It might be possible. And just because you enter monastic life doesn't mean you will break the cycle either. It's not that many monastics who actually go that far on the path. It's quite rare, because it takes a lot of commitment even in monastic life to do it. So you just do your best. You do what you can do, and you see how life unfolds. And then when you do that, then things will unfold in a certain way. Sometimes people are better off not becoming monastics because maybe that is not what kind of suits their temperament, perhaps. For other people, it might be the right thing. So it really just depends on you and your situation. Don't force it. If you force it too much, it tends to backfire badly. So just go with the flow and see what happens. And then when you're ready, then you can maybe become a monastic. Try it out sometimes. Try out monasticism. Come to a monastery. Stay for a while. See what it feels like. And then you may hate it. You may never come back again. Then you're done with that. Finished with that. Or you may really love it. So you just stay on. You cling on to the monastery. When Ajahn Brahm or Venerable Hasapanya says, okay, now you have stayed your month. You can't stay any longer. Then you chain yourself to the front gate of the monastery. This is a smart move, isn't it? Because they can't do anything about you. And sometimes what happens is that if someone is so persistent that they chain themselves to the front gate, then Ajahn Brahm says, yeah, this is a really good candidate. Okay, you can stay here. You have to kind of prove your mettle. Prove that you're really worth it. Sometimes it works like that. Anyway, so please don't tell Ajahn Brahm I'm saying these things. I might get into some serious problems. Okay, next one. Dear Ajahn, can you explain how walking meditation can lead to stillness? And the way it works is exactly the same way as breath meditation works to stillness. You're focusing on one thing exclusively, and you allow your attention to be drawn into that to the exclusion of everything else. So in breath meditation, as you calm down, you let the world go, gradually your mind kind of lets go of everything else, and all that exists is the breath. Walking meditation is exactly the same idea, except that you focus on something else usually, like your feet. You focus on your feet, touching the ground, lifting up, moving, etc. And after a while, your mind focuses in on those feet to the exclusion of everything else. And this is the idea of stillness in this case. It's not as still as you might find in breath meditation, but there is a degree of focus there, and that degree of focus is a kind of stillness. It is not a jhana state, it is not a samadhi state, it is not absolute stillness, but there is a degree of stillness. So that is really what is meant by that. In the suttas, it specifically says that if you do walking meditation and you gain samadhi, it is a kind of stillness that lasts for a long time. And the reason is because you are active and you learn how to focus while you're active, so it kind of goes on for a longer time as a consequence. Dear Ajahn, Anapanasati Sutta recommends meditation in solitude. However, at least for beginners, practicing as a group seems helpful. Yes, I agree with that. Is there any comment in the suttas on meditating as a group? Not really. The suttas are really advanced. They always talk about kind of, when they talk about meditation, they talk about kind of real meditation. No, kind of there's really, Buddha talks about things at a very high level usually. So there's nothing there, but you are right, especially when you're still kind of getting your mind settled down, you're moving in the right direction, it can be very useful to have a group of people around you who kind of do the same thing, and you kind of create a nice atmosphere of peace and stillness in a beautiful place like Jhanagar, with a beautiful days outside. I've been absolutely stunning so far, and it kind of brings you more inspiration when the weather is so marvelous. And so all of that brings together a very positive thing. The most important thing here is to like have a positive atmosphere. Yeah, when you feel that the atmosphere is good, and you feel at ease, you are relaxed because everyone is kind of being kind and gentle, and that allows you to enjoy that group feeling, the group atmosphere that can help you along. For a beginner, it can be quite hard to meditate at home, yeah, because you have to create that atmosphere by yourself. It can be quite hard. You have to get in the right mood yourself. It can be quite difficult. So to do that when you are at home, it is important to have a situation whereby you can create that atmosphere and get into the right mood for meditation practice. It means that you can have a little place that you normally sit. Maybe you have some candles that you light, yeah, so you create a nice atmosphere, a bit like the lighting in here, quite inspiring lighting when the light goes down. It can be about maybe listening to some chanting or listening to a guided meditation to kind of get the atmosphere going. And all of these things can put you in the mood for meditation practice. So do things that kind of are supportive in that way, and then it can be helpful. So the point really is that when meditation really takes off, when samadhi really starts to become incredibly powerful, and the Buddha says in the sutta, this is really only when you get to the jhanas, or to the doorstep of the jhanas, just as you're about to enter very profound samadhi, that is really when you should seek absolute solitude, real solitude. In the meantime, it's a bit more, it is not quite as important. It is all about how deep your meditation is. The deeper it is, the more solitude you require to kind of sustain the depth of the meditation. Okay, Ajahn, thank you for teaching us and for sharing. I've heard Bhante Sujata say the Metta Sutta was composed a couple hundred years after the Buddha. I like the Metta Sutta, but the bit about the mother rings a little false. I love my mum. I think mothers are amazing, but my mum, who is very good, is also very attached and thus tries to control and suffers and causes suffering for others when she can't get her way, I suppose. In the suttas, the example of Kisa Gotami comes to mind. In the suttas, the highest expression of metta is not a mum, but someone who lets go, who is let go, the Buddha. The Buddha is regarded as a teacher and chief friend. Thus, it is a good teacher and friends, not mothers and fathers, who are the best expression of metta. Yes, I think there is something to that, and it is true, the Metta Sutta only exists in the Pali version. There's no version in any other language, which is kind of interesting, so it makes you wonder whether it is, how original it is. It doesn't mean that it's not original just because it doesn't exist in other versions, but it may mean that. Yeah, it's hard to really know. It is not... There is some grounds for doubt as far as the Metta Sutta is concerned. The idea about motherly love, in a sense, I agree with you. Yeah, there is a degree of attachment there. It may not be the ideal kind of metta. And of course, if you're an arahant or whatever, and you really have developed your mind, then that metta is going to be more pure, no doubt about it. But the general idea is a beautiful one. Yeah, it is an idea that you can use, and you can use it in the sense that why is it that a mother is able to love her children? What is actually going on there? Some of it is attachment, but some of it also is the fact that a mother has seen that child in all different situations. She has seen the good qualities. She has seen that when the child was young and innocent, yeah, and kind of running around or whatever. And because a mother has seen all of those stages of the life of her child, she's always able to remember the good things. And that is such a useful thing to remember. This is what metta really is about, is your ability to see the good qualities in other people. Yeah, so that is what is so beautiful about it. So think yourself, if you think of yourself as a mother, not in the attached sense, but in the sense of someone who is able to see the good qualities in others, then that is the right way of doing it. Otherwise, you get attached to everybody. Yeah, if you are the mother, everyone, get attached to everyone. Actually, it's impossible to be attached to everyone, so forget about that. That's not going to happen anyway. You can only be attached to a few people. But that would be kind of that would be bad, yeah, as if we haven't got enough attachments already. So don't go down that track. I think it's about reading these messages in the right way. And if you read them in the right way, then they start to become powerful and useful. So I agree with you, but I also think that the message can be used in a way that is actually helpful to practice metta. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I heard some monastic teachers said that Sotapanna can be attained by listening to the Dhamma, the quote of the Nikayas, and not necessarily to have jhana experience. Is that true? Thank you. Is that true? No, I say it is partly true, but partly not true. Is that good enough? Okay. I will elaborate a little bit. Otherwise, I'm kind of leaving you short. But what that sutta says, it is a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. It talks about the five ayatanas for becoming a stream enterer or for liberation or whatever. Vimuttayatana, I think it's called. And there's different ways of becoming liberated. Some of those ways are to recite the Dhamma for yourself, to teach someone else, and one of them is meditation practice. And the point is not that just listening to the Dhamma makes you liberated as such. If you read that sutta carefully, what it says is that you listen to the Dhamma, and based on those teachings, because those listening to the Dhamma can sometimes make you give you all of these good qualities in your mind. So based on that, the process of samadhi happens. Then you get into samadhi. Then after samadhi, you have the insight into things according to reality. That's what that sutta actually says. So the listening to the Dhamma is only the cause that sets in motion the whole sequence of events that eventually leads you to awakening or leads you to stream entry. Just listening to the Dhamma on its own is not going to be enough. Then otherwise we would have lots of sotapannas around. Yeah? So it's not sufficient. Okay, so I hope that answers that one. Dear sir, does the 6 of the 8 precepts allow the practitioner to have milk with tea or coffee after midday? What do monks at Bodhinyana follow on this? Well, these are trade secrets. I can't say, tell you that. What do we do? No, they're not trade secrets. Is it allowable after midday? It depends on who you ask. Yeah. So some monks will say, absolutely not allowable. Other way people say, of course it's allowable. So this is kind of this is the problem with some of these things, that they are kind of grayish, slightly grayish areas. Most monks and monastics probably say it's not allowable. And in our monastery, we usually don't have any milk after midday. Actually, we don't. That's kind of the rule of the monastery. But Ajahn Brahm is kind of, he's not saying absolutely one way or the other. He's saying that it depends on your interpretation. So, are you allowed to have milk after midday? I don't want to kind of make life difficult for Bianca and kind of say something is allowable. I don't know what she has said or if you have any rules about this, but it's not a big deal. Yeah, if you do have milk in your coffee or tea after midday, I would say that it's nothing. Yeah, if that is possible, if it can be done, if it should be done or whatever, no problem as far as I'm concerned. Please do so. Some monastics do it as well. So it just depends on the situation. It is important not to become too nitpicky about these 8 precepts. It's a general guideline for how to live well. In some places in Thailand, for example, and sometimes with monks, also for our monastery, not actually at Bodhinyana, but sometimes outside, we'd also have cheese in the afternoon. But if you told monks in Sri Lanka or Burma that we have cheese in the afternoon, I think that we are really evil monks. Cheese, it must be jogging, cheese in the afternoon. That's really, really bad. You're not keeping your precepts properly. But important to remember that these are minor things of the monastic vinaya. These are not important things. These are not the things that are going to make a difference for whether you can attain samadhi or not. The main point is that you have integrity in how you live. Yeah. So if you make a decision, then you stick to that decision and you don't kind of mess around and go further and kind of undermine your precepts in general. That is really the main issue here. So you have some clear boundaries. That is what matters. But whether you have cheese or not is actually a very small thing. Some monks will look down upon you having chocolate in the afternoon, but again, it's a small thing. It's strange. Sometimes the small things are the ones we argue the most about. It's crazy, isn't it? It's really, really nuts, actually. As if they really don't really matter at all. So as a layperson, I would just try to. Of course, there are things that monastics definitely should not do, absolutely should not do, that are really bad. And then, of course, you have grounds for being a bit careful. But with many of these things, it is very, very minor here. Okay. And especially for lay people on the eight precepts, I would say it is even less important. Okay. Ajahn, in your talk today, how does one tranquilize feelings, especially the negative ones? You don't tranquilize negative feelings. Yeah, what you do is that you overcome them, and the ones that you tranquilize are the positive feelings. Negative feelings, you have to first overcome them by right thinking. This is where the patisankhana bala, the power of reflection, comes in, so that you overcome the negative attitudes and negative things that you may have. So if you have ill will, don't calm it down. Overcome it by metta. Overcome it by reflection. Then sit down and calm down your mind afterwards. If you try to calm down the ill will, it is often you end up suppressing it and pushing it down, and it ends up with all kind of problems as a consequence. The Buddha always gives a hierarchy of how the practice works, yeah, in calming the mind. You start out by calming down the most coarse things, the kind of the ordinary bad thoughts in your mind. Then you calm down, or you get rid of the middling bad thoughts. And then eventually, when you only have good thoughts left, you calm down the good thoughts to enter samadhi. Important to get that sequence right. Don't try to calm down the negative thinking, because if you do, you are just going to end up with problems as a consequence. So that is the right way, and the tranquilization of feeling. Once you have positive feelings, the way to do that is just to watch the breath, and then everything becomes more peaceful as a consequence. Number two, if we are to contemplate impermanence, why do we need to develop rapture and experience it in our minds? I will talk about that later on, but the point is that there's two things that happen when you experience rapture, and the deeper you go in your meditation, the more powerful your mind is going to be, and for that reason, the more ability you will have to contemplate impermanence, because your mind is very powerful. But also, the deeper you go in meditation, remember what we said before about the seven factors of awakening being based on viveka, on viraga and nirodha, based on seclusion, fading away and cessation. The idea is that the more things cease in your meditation, the more they fade away, the easier it is to understand impermanence. Impermanence, the ability to see impermanence depends on the degree to which things are actually, you can see them directly as impermanent. If something ceases, you see the full impermanence of something. It is completely impermanent because it is completely gone. Especially when you can't even have access to it anymore, it's completely gone outside of your access field. Then you understand impermanence in a very profound way. And this is why this is so important, and why this sequence, and we will see this tomorrow when we go through the last part of the Anapanasati Sutta, how that actually works. Okay. Dear sir, when this type... wrong side, okay. Oh, two sides, you're really using the paper well here, that's good. No, okay. Venerable sir, after patiently sitting for an hour or so, dealing with various thoughts, somehow I managed to bring my focus into the breath. Excellent. Well done. That's really, really good. Yeah? I could clearly see the breath coming in and going out through the passage of my nose. But in the background, back pain started gradually. This became stronger until the pain became louder than the breath. Then I started focusing on the exact point I felt the pain in my mind, massaging it gently, but it didn't help. So I gave up and got up. Dear sir, when this type of disturbances come up, what's the trick I should use? By the way, this wasn't the first time I experienced this sort of issue with my meditation. What is the trick? Well, there may not really be any tricks, unfortunately. You know, everybody wants the magic bullet to kind of bang, it's all gone. But pain is a problem in meditation practice, and sometimes you can't really overcome it. Sometimes it persists, especially if you sit for long periods of time. The longer you sit, and if your meditation doesn't go very deep, then the pain is almost bound to disturb you eventually. If your meditation goes deep enough, then the pain will also no longer be able to disturb you, but that takes a lot of skill and a lot of depth in meditation practice. So the best thing to do is to, if you have a back pain, really the best thing to do is probably to, if you can't overcome it within a fairly short amount of time, just get up and do something else. Yeah, change your posture. Go walking a little bit. Do something different. What you really have to do is you have to kind of get to that breath a little bit quicker. And the way to do that is that you don't disturb your mind in between the meditations. So after the meditation, you get up, you do some walking in the forest, you do some walking meditation, just back and forth, enjoying the peace, half an hour, whatever you want. Then you come back. You haven't really disturbed the mind so much. Then, next time around, you will get the breath into focus much more quickly. Yeah, this is really the idea. If it takes an hour just to get the breath in focus, well, no wonder your body starts to get a bit fed up, yeah, and you get a bit of pain. That is to be expected if you sit for so long without really having any focus. That's kind of natural. So try instead to kind of build up the momentum over a long period of time by not disturbing your mind in the meantime. Okay, so I hope that works. Let's see what happens. Dear Bhante, were the jhanas discovered by the Buddha? Or did ascetics know of this kind of samadhi in the ancient India before the Buddha? Also, did Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, get into a jhana while meditating by watching the farmer plow when he was a child? Were the jhanas discovered by the Buddha? I have to be careful here because this is a controversial topic and Ajahn Brahm has his own kind of ideas on this one. So if I said the wrong thing, that might be very problematic for me afterwards. So this is going to be top secret. Yeah, please, no one outside this room is allowed to know what I'm about to say now. No, I'm just messing around. What is nice about Ajahn Brahm is that he doesn't mind if you disagree with him. It's kind of really nice. Ajahn Brahm, I can tell him that I disagree and he will just shrug his shoulders and say whatever. He's not gonna be bothered at all. And this is what it should be like when you have a teacher. So, there is a passage in the suttas where it is says that the Buddha abhujji to the jhanas. Abhujji means awakened to the jhanas. And the question is, how do we interpret that? What is the meaning of that? It does seem from other passages in the suttas, like the Buddha's path to awakening, that deep samadhi already existed in India at the time. It looks like things like jhanas already were attained occasionally by people. That's what it looks like. It's difficult to be absolutely sure, but it seems to be that way. So what does it mean then that the Buddha awakened to jhana, if that is right? What I take it to mean is that he understood the purpose of jhana on the path. Yeah, how it actually leads to awakening. What kind of support it requires to take you all the way to awakening. And especially, if you remember the life story of the Buddha, there is a moment in the Mahasatchaka Sutta. This is the sutta to a fellow called Satchaka, Majjhima Nikaya number 36, and it shows the whole story of how the Buddha became enlightened. There's a point there, after he gives up the ascetic practices, when he thinks, wow, I'm trying all these ascetic practices, doesn't get me anywhere, is there another path to awakening? And at that point, he realizes that the experience he had as a child, when he had a jhana experience, he realized that is the path to awakening. And that is a bit like awakening to jhana, yeah? You're awakening to its purpose, to what it can do for you as an aspect of the path. And that is what I think it is most likely to mean. So that is just my position on that. So did he have the first jhana while watching the farmer. The farmer happened to be his father, actually. And it seems so, because he mentioned that in the sutta. Yeah, he actually says that he had that experience as a child. So it seems that actually what happened. Yeah, and this apparently is quite, can happen for children. It's quite common. As when you're a young child, you're still quite perhaps innocent. You just sit down, and sometimes you have children getting into samadhi experiences because they are, you know, they are more, they haven't kind of got into the kind of the rat race yet, and they're kind of not kind of driven by ego and the self and by always doing in the same way as you are when you get older. So because of that, it might be easier for a child, sometimes small child especially, to get into a state of samadhi perhaps, sitting under the rose apple tree and just blissing out. It's a nice kind of nice idea, and I think it is quite likely to be true, because I think that story is found across all the various Buddhist traditions, wherever you look. Okay. Dear Ajahn, there are many places in the suttas where a newcomer to the Dhamma going to the Buddha to ask for a teaching. Do the suttas mention any other system having been set up, like arahants or senior monks in monasteries, spreading the word of the Dhamma to the masses? With metta to you. Yes. I don't think there is a system. Yeah, there isn't really any system of spreading the Dhamma. There is more like, you know, one of the things that you find in the Mahavagga. Mahavagga is one of the books of the Vinaya Pitaka. Actually, Mahavagga is used for a few different things, but that is one thing it means. And in the Mahavagga, there's something called the Mahakandaka. Kandaka is a chapter, the great chapter. And in that, you find the story of how the Sangha arose, how the Buddha formed the Sangha, the monastic Sangha. And in that story, the Buddha starts out with the five ascetics, and then kind of gradually grows, and eventually there's about 60 arahants. And when there is 60 arahants, the Buddha says to them, well, now, you know, you all have been taught well, you know the Dhamma, so go out and spread the teaching in the world. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? That the only place where the Buddha specifically says to the monks, at that time they were only monks, he tells them to go out and spread the teaching here. Is it an authentic passage? Not 100% sure, but it is possible, yeah? Because it is a beautiful teaching, it's a beautiful Dhamma that has so much potential for giving people happiness. Why shouldn't the monks want to spread that message to people in the world? Usually, Buddhism is not really a proselytizing religion. It's not about converting people. It's more about making the Dhamma available so that anyone who is interested can come and hear these teachings. But it's more like that. It's not kind of going knocking on people's door and saying, yeah, are you a Christian? Okay, that's bad. You must become a Buddhist. Yeah, it's not about that, because that creates too much conflict. It's more like just making things available that is important. That was done very often at the time of the Buddha. It was done by lay people at that time would often come to the monasteries, yeah? And they would come and stay there, especially on the Uposatha days, and then they would listen to the teachings as a consequence. And of course, at that time, the monastics were quite visible, because the monastics would go into the cities and the villages and places to go for alms, yeah? Very common in those days, so you always saw the monastics. You couldn't, you know, they were always around, but now we kind of live in our monastery. We're not really visible so much in the city. So people don't have that same access to seeing that there are people practicing the spiritual life in the same way. So the society is a bit different. So there is a point there. At that time, monastics were more accessible than perhaps they are now. And that is, I think, an important point. But I think what we're doing at the Buddha Society here in WA is quite nice. We make these teachings available on the internet. Anyone who is interested can have access to them. And we just have to let people know that they are there, that they are available if people are interested. And that, I think, is the most important thing that we can do. Of course, what we can also do is maybe translate the talks into other languages. That is happening a little bit. There is one of the one of the people on the BSW is very much into this, and that is what he spends his time doing, helping to create translations of talks. And that's quite a nice one, because a lot of people in the world don't have English as their first language, and it can be hard for them to understand. Yeah, maybe places like China or Indonesia, or even like in maybe France perhaps, yeah, or something like that, where people's English isn't that great, and then it can be helpful to have things translated. So things like that are good to do to make it available, and that I think is the main purpose of that. We should do as monastics. Okay. Sometimes I think I am being kind, but I see later I have interrupted someone's process. I haven't minded my own business. How to know when is kindness and when it is the judgment and control? Okay. First of all, don't set the bar too high. Don't set the bar so high that you are never kind. Don't ask yourself to be perfect before you are kind. It is very hard to act from an entirely pure mind, a mind that is absolutely bright and pure. Really, the only time you do that is after a state of samadhi, when the mind is absolutely brilliant, and there's no defilements or attachments or anything like that in your mind. That is the only time you act from complete purity. Before that, there may be some vested interest. There may be some self-concern. Yeah, that is okay. Just continue to be kind and investigate what you're doing. And as you do that, you will uncover your negative motivations, and you will see more clearly what are your positive motivations. So the fact that you are already seeing this means that you're on the right track. Yeah, you're starting to see what actually is the right way to be kind to other people. So continue doing that, and just investigate yourself, investigate your own conduct, and don't demand too much of yourself. The fact that you want to be kind, the fact that you're even asking this kind of question, is great. Yeah, it means that you're on the right track. You're on the highway to becoming a better person, even better than you are now. You're probably really good already, but even better as a consequence of that kind of investigation into your own conduct. So just keep on looking. And when you know that you are being controlling and judgmental, then ask yourself, how can I be kind without being controlling and judgmental? How can I just allow people to be, allow people to live their own life, and just be kind with no ulterior motive, just to be kind for kindness's sake, so that you can feel the joy, you can feel that ornament of the mind, making your own mind beautiful, that when you come down to sit meditation, you feel, yay, I'm living a good life. Yeah, I'm keeping the five precepts. Wow, how wonderful that is. And you have this sense of contentment inside of yourself, this knowledge that you're living well. It is not an ego trip at all. It's just a good feeling in the heart, because you know that your life is a life well lived. Yeah. So because of that, you just have this natural sense of joy inside of you because of that. And that is the right kind of thing that should arise out of good conduct in the long run. But you are on the right track. So don't just keep on going, and then you will find and resolve that issue yourself over time. Dear Ajahn, what is your view about silence of the mind? Ajahn Sumedho. Silence of the mind. You mean the sound of silence? Is that what you mean? The silence of the mind? I know that he talks about the sound of silence sometimes. Is that maybe what you mean? Different skillful means to make the mind peaceful, yeah? And whatever skillful mean that you use to make the mind peaceful is okay. So what you have to ask yourself is always whether you are making progress or not. That is the only criteria that matters to decide whether something is good or bad. A large number of techniques may be good, depending on how you use them and how you apply them. So ask yourself, does the technique work? If it works, it's good. If it makes you peaceful, it is useful to use, so you can use that. But also remember that the main, most powerful teachings are usually found in the suttas. If you want to know the best method to practice meditation, it is likely to be the Buddha who can show you that best method. So I would always argue, come back if you can to the breath, if you are able to. I know that there are some of you who may not like the breath, but and for whatever reason, for the history that you have made with it or whatever, but try occasionally to come back to it and see if you can re-establish a relationship with the breath. Yeah, every few months, try again and see if you can find out the cause for why you have somehow it doesn't work for you. You may find that eventually you're able to come back to the breath again and use it as a vehicle. Perhaps, yeah? Maybe not, but maybe you will. Who knows? So come back to what the Buddha says. That is always the most powerful. And if this kind of idea works, if it has good effect, you can use that too. But in the end, it is the word of the Buddha that tends to be the most powerful. Okay. Ajahn, for people who suffer a lot or encounter many misfortunes, they or we should have more chances of getting right view and give up hope on the sensual world. Why doesn't right view kick in? Okay. Does that mean we are utterly stupid and hopeless? Does it mean you're utterly stupid and hopeless? Well, it does not mean you're hopeless, yeah? Because hopeless means that there is no, you're not going anywhere, but of course you're not hopeless. Everyone has hope, and this is kind of the whole point of this path, that there is, everyone has a chance of developing and moving forward. You can never say to anyone that they're utterly stupid and hopeless. I hope you don't think that about yourself, because that's going to kind of probably just drag you down. And the reason why nothing happens, you suffer a lot and encounter misfortune, and still you don't get right view. The reason why you don't get right view is because you think about it in the wrong way. You're not used to think about it in the right way. I was just speaking to someone today. And usually, if there is a problem or a misfortune or something, the worldly way is to try to resolve it, to find a solution. Yeah? This is what people normally do in the world. But the problem is that maybe you can resolve it, maybe you can't. But even if you can resolve it, there's always another problem waiting behind. Yeah? There's no end to problems. And the problems will always continue for as long as there is a samsaric existence, there will be problems. That's the nature of samsara. So it is basically a wrong attitude to the problems of life. So instead of having that attitude, you change your view and you start to realize, actually, this is the nature of the world. There's always going to be problems. I can solve problems, but do I really want to solve problems from now to eternity? Is that a meaningful thing, just to keep on solving the same problem again and again and again? You forget that you have already solved that problem in the past life. Yeah, and in the past life before that. And you have already solved the exact same problem a million times before. When are you going to get fed up with solving that problem? Yeah, the problem of being of relationship problems especially. They keep on going. Work problems, they keep on going forever and ever and ever. There is no final solution in that sphere. So you start to get that, and when you get that, your attitude to life changes. And instead of trying to look for those solutions, instead of looking for those goals, these are all about goals, having to achieve a certain goal, solving a problem. Instead of looking for those goals, you look at the process. You look at how to get there. How do we have a good family? Yeah. What is the daily kind of way of living with other people that maximizes benefit on the spiritual path? The process is what starts to matter, rather than, there may not be a solution to all those problems. And it doesn't matter. You don't have to find a solution. Instead, you look at the process. You look at how to live your life well, so as to improve your general mental state, improve your kindness and all these other qualities. And then you know that you're not wasting your time. You know you're moving in the right direction. And as you do that, something marvelous happens. Your ability to resolve the problems of the world start to seem less problematic. They don't touch you so much anymore, because you have an inner goal, you have inner happiness that is untouched by the external world. So you become more free. You become more independent of the external world. There may still be problems in the external world, but you shrug your shoulders. Okay, well, it's, you know, the world will go wherever it wants. It's got nothing to do with you anymore because you're heading in a different direction. And that's really nice. It's really beautiful when that happens. So learn from the problem. This is what we mean by learning when you have problems. You learn to understand that actually, unfortunately, there's always going to be problems if you have to look for a solution in a different place. So that is when right view starts to kick in. So you have to have the teachings of the Buddha. You have to have that seed planted in your mind that helps you to look at things in the right way. Without that seed, you will usually end up running around in circles, round and round and round, doing the same thing again and again and again, never learning. It's not because you are stupid, or you could say it is, maybe it is because you are stupid, but because we are all stupid. Yeah, that's the problem. We all have the same delusion, the same problem. It's not about you, it's just about the condition of being a human being or being any kind of being. So that is the problem. It is useful to see that because you can see the depth of the delusion right there. You start to understand how deeply immersed we are in the problem. And when you understand that, it gives you a little bit of energy. Yeah, I've got to get practicing. I've got to live well because you see the danger in these things and how it self-perpetuates in samsaric existence, going from life to life, eon to eon, from whatever it is to whatever it is, and carries on like that. Two more questions. I will do those as well, just to finish it off. First one, to what extent should giving be done? In the Buddhist literature, there is a story of a Brahmin who offers his and his wife's only cloth. While this is very inspirational, inspirational, it is something done outside of a common person's comfort level. How should one develop such strong foundation of mind to not go wrong about the practicality of giving while pursuing spirituality? Thank you. So one of the nice things that the Buddha says about generosity or how to use your wealth is that you should always start with using your wealth on yourself. Quite nice, isn't it? You're allowed to look after yourself, to maybe indulge a little bit as well. Look after yourself. Yeah, make sure that you are comfortable, that you have a good life. Don't give away your last cloth. Yeah, keep that last cloth. Get last cloth. It comes in very handy, as you say. So actually keep much more than the last cloth. Keep the second last, the third last, the fourth last cloth. Yeah, and much more besides. Look after yourself. Make sure that you make yourself happy with whatever wealth you have. And then, because kindness to oneself is actually one of the bases of being able to meditate anyway. Once you have looked after yourself, look after the people who are closest to you. If you have a family, make sure you look after all your family members, that they are all happy and comfortable and at ease. Don't spoil them. There's no point in spoiling them, but make sure that at the very least that they are at ease and they are enjoying their life. Then look after the broader, perhaps, people around you, larger family, friends and acquaintances and all of these things. Yeah, look after that. And then whatever is left over after that, you use for charity. Yeah, giving a little bit to Buddhist causes, giving a little bit to other charity, whatever it is. So you use your wealth wisely in this way. So then you're doing it in the right way. I know that there are all these stories in Buddhist literature of kind of people giving to, and these are nice stories, but remember they're only stories, and they're not really meant to be followed literally. What is meant to be followed literally is what you find in the suttas. So when the Buddha says that you should look after yourself first, that is what you should follow literally, not these kind of stories. Okay. Last question for tonight. Ajahn, two nights ago you talked about application of sati versus just letting sati arise by itself. Can you please explain more in case I didn't get it right? Okay, so The idea is that when you start out and your meditation, you're not really ready yet to meditate, yeah, because your mind doesn't have any clarity, you are all over the place thinking about the past and the future, but all kinds of things. You have to allow yourself to calm down and become at ease, some mindfulness to arise before you actually can apply that mindfulness to a meditation object, the breath, for example. Yeah, so you have to kind of just learn to relax, allow the world to be left behind, allow the beautiful peace and atmosphere of jhana grow to infiltrate your mind and your heart, so you kind of become naturally peaceful. Yeah, and then when that peacefulness starts to arise inside of you, you start to feel the mindfulness is there just by sitting back, just by enjoying the peace. That is when you start applying that mindfulness to the meditation object. Before that, the breath may already be there, but you know, because the breath is kind of always there in a sense, it's always around, but you don't make any effort to focus on it. You just leave it kind of in the background, and you just rest and you allow things to be here. But after a while, when the mindfulness starts to become strong, the breath comes clearer into focus, and then you stay with that breath in a different way. You apply yourself very gently to the breath. Ideally, not too much willpower, but just enough to kind of stay with the breath and allowing it to be nice and easy and comfortable, and then hopefully that experience will then grow, and gradually you become even more peaceful, more happy, and everything grows beautifully as a consequence. Okay, that is all for tonight. So have another nice night, have a good night rest, sleep well, and then we will see you back again tomorrow morning here.